You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be running out of door.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of water. And you fry some garlic.
It's
and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce. Mastitos,
yeah. I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. I hope you've had a good weekend. I hope you haven't been inhibited by the rain or rained out of any special events, and that in spite of the rain or maybe because of it, you had a chance to get to at least one farmer's market. I love the farmer's markets in the rain, as long as the wind's not blowing too hard. Today's Sebastopol Farmer's Market was absolutely wonderful, and it looked like nearly every farmer, every vendor, just about. I saw a couple who were not there, but they weren't even the farmers. The masseuse wasn't there, and that kind of makes sense. But everybody else was there. It was a really nice market. And we're going to be talking tonight, in part, about farmers markets. But before I introduce our guests, I want to sort of create a little bit of a historical tradition for what we're going to be talking about, at least in part, and also add an anecdote that resonates with something in the beginning of the book, which is the wisdom of the radish. I was lucky enough to have, and I just forgot her name. Oh my gosh. The great Mexican cookbook writer, Diana Kennedy, just flew out of my head like a little bird. She's been on the show twice, and the first time she came on, wanted to find out why this woman with this very nice British accent had ended up in Mexico and was this amazing expert, I think the most knowledgeable person in the English language on Mexican cooking today. And I said, well, Diana, welcome. And what took you to Mexico? And she just looked at me like, what's wrong with you? And she said, well, a man, of course. And I barely knew what to say after that. I was so surprised, but it makes so much sense. And then as I was reading The Wisdom of the Radish and discussing it with a friend of mine, she said, that's so like The Egg and I. And The Egg and I is a book that was written in the 1940s by Betty McDonald. It later became a film, at least one screen adaptation, starring Fred McMurray and Claudette Colbert, and it's about a woman who goes out into the wilderness on a chicken ranch with her new husband. And then I also just happened to pick up the May 9th issue of The New Yorker. And I'm in the middle of an article called Oh Pioneer Woman. And it's about a woman who is blogging about her life on a farm. And she wrote a memoir called Black Heels to Tractor Wheels. And she's followed it up with The Pioneer Woman Cooks, Recipes from an Accidental Country Girl. And both books as well as the blog are extremely popular. And it seems that there's just no waning of interest in the city person decides they're going to the farm. And I find this really refreshing, particularly because it's welcome news when we hear about how small family farms are disappearing and all of the many things that both certain government regulations and corporate lobbyists are throwing in the path of family farms. So it's great to see the the tradition continuing. And on that note, I want to welcome the author, Linda Hopkins.
Hello.
With a baby in your arms, but you have to describe the baby.
She's, I guess, I'm probably guessing about 3 pounds, and we brought her over here in a cat carrier, which she only filled about a quarter of a cat carrier, if you can imagine that. She's a little baby Nigerian dwarf goat, and her name is Charlotte.
And her mother is Emily.
Yes.
It's the Bronte line.
Yes.
Has there been a Heathcliff yet?
No. But actually, yeah, her kid from last year was called Emilio because he was a carbon copy of his mother. So we sort of broke the literary tradition for that one.
There's nothing like a baby goat.
No.
Baby goats really enjoy human contact. And you can just see that in the way she's so cuddled on your lap. Also in the studio with us is the farmer, Emmett Hopkins.
Hello. Good evening.
Welcome. You two have Foggy Bottom Farm.
Foggy River Farm.
I knew that. Foggy River. I knew that.
You're not the first person to make that mistake. Somehow it just rolls off of people's tongues.
It does. Yeah. And you have to remember to say Foggy. I practice Foggy River driving here and there. I blew it. And you at your booth, at your stall in the Hillsburg Farmers Market, you have a book, a binder with photographs of your chickens.
Right.
And I loved that.
Yeah,
we like
to share with people a little bit more about the farm because since we don't have a farm stand where we're selling right out at the farm and people can't actually see it growing, we like to have a little bit more than just the produce in front of them.
Mm-hmm. And where exactly is the farm located?
It's on East Side Road, about 10 minutes south of Healdsburg, kind of triangulated between Windsor, Healdsburg, and Forestville, right on the floodplain of the Russian River.
On the floodplain. And you haven't flooded since you've been there, have you?
No, we haven't actually. Yeah. We've had 3 flood-free winters.
Yeah.
Rare.
Yeah, or then there's the drought winters that we haven't had one of those in a long time either, but that's another challenge. When did you start farming?
Well, I guess I started growing vegetables would be a distinction quite a long time ago. I've always really loved it. But we started farming on a bigger scale about 3 years ago. So we're entering our 4th season now.
Mm-hmm. And when did you move up here from San Diego?
Well, we met when we were in college, so I sort of had a northward trajectory. We both went to Stanford, so I was sort of with the Bay Area. And then it was just when we started farming 3.5 years ago that I moved up for good. So.
Now, do you have a background in Sonoma County? Are you from here originally?
Yeah, I do. I grew up on the same property where we're farming now, actually.
Oh, great.
So I grew up on the kind of ranch property that my grandparents bought in the 50s. And it was, at that point, it was in prunes and pears, largely. My grandmother ran it for quite a while by herself. Eventually, she decided she was going to move back east. And my dad and mom decided to come back, and then they shifted into wine grapes, and now we're doing a little piece of vegetables and goats and chickens.
And are your parents still farming the wine grapes?
Yep.
So it's a real family endeavor. That's just great.
Yeah, it is. So partly, like, the book is, it's a story of kind of succession farming, but partly it's a story of farming for the first time, and because vegetable farming is new to the property, relatively speaking, and Linda, I guess, when did you start farming?
Really just 3.5 years ago. I was born and raised in suburban San Diego. Yeah. Really had no
agriculture. Whereabouts in San Diego?
I went to school in La Jolla, high school in La Jolla, and then lived just east of there in University City.
Okay.
So, but yeah, I mean, I had, a dog, and that was the closest thing that I had to, livestock or animals or anything like that.
Doesn't sound like your mother gardened or cooked much.
No. I was sort of a macaroni and cheese kind of kid. Uh-huh. And my mom does cook steak and potatoes very well. But that's about it. So vegetables were even new to me. And actually, Emmett, when we first started dating, was my food coach and teaching me to eat a more sort of diverse array of things for dinner. So introducing things like, artichokes, zucchini, which you would think would be normal for someone eating in California, but
I know that's
it's not.
So, I know that's so amazing. I remember my first artichoke. I think I was 3.
Yeah.
My mother was not much of a cook, but she brought artichokes into my life, and we during the artichoke season, we had them at least once a week. So, right there in San Diego.
Yeah, where everything grows. Yeah, I didn't actually have my first orange until I was a senior in high school. And I mean, Southern California is citrus country.
Absolutely.
Just wasn't on my family's radar. So
how did the book come about initially?
I've always loved writing, and mm-hmm. I've always wanted to write a book. And actually, originally, Emmett and I actually wrote another book, but the topic wasn't exciting enough to be published. We wrote a book on public transportation. We actually traveled around the country on buses and
that
trains.
That should be published.
You would think, right? But and then no one was interested in buying it, so sort of my literary agent suggested to pitch something else, and everyone loves farming right now, so that was a very exciting topic. Elizabeth Kaplan in New York City.
Uh-huh. So. She should go back to work on that public transportation book. I think that's really timely. You know, there's so much discussion about that in the public sphere.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it only seems that that discussion lasts as long as the gas prices are insanely high, and then once they dipped back down again, everyone forgets about buses. But it definitely is a cyclical conversation,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, absolutely. When did you pitch this?
Gosh, I think it must be a couple, maybe even 3 years ago. Yeah, it was. After, I mean, it was sort of
so
when,
right
we started,
when you were starting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was basically sort of writing it and farming at the same time. Mm-hmm. So the book definitely evolved as our season progressed.
Mm-hmm. And you had, as you would expect for anyone, you had some real challenges when you started.
Definitely. We did have farming experience before we started farming. We had been living up in Port Townsend, Washington for a while.
Love that
and
place.
It's beautiful, yeah. And we had volunteered at farms up there. And then we actually spent some time traveling in New Zealand. We had saved up during college and sort of went on this exciting trip. And we worked on a lot of different organic farms there. But there's a very big difference between working on someone's organic farm and running your own organic farm, as
or
we
even
found
starting
out.
Starting it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Starting it.
Right, because there are no systems in place, and you have to develop, you know, everything from irrigation to crop rotation. So,
The book opens with baby greens, and one thing that I found really interesting about that is, and I'm not going to remember, it might have been Wine Country Cuisine back in the 80s. There were actually a couple of different growers, and that was the very first crop that we could call of the new period of Sonoma County as a food mecca. That was the first crop to grow, to go national.
Right.
So it was interesting. It's like, okay, so you started, you sort of mimicked a little bit of Sonoma County's renaissance, you could say.
Yeah. And one of the big advantages of the baby greens, too, are that they're a cut-and-come-again harvest, and they also grow mm-hmm. very quickly. So, mm-hmm. You know, you sort of see them once. Depending on the weather, they could be ready in as early as, what would you say, two?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if it's a lot colder, you know, it'll take a month or more. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, you harvest them for market, and then they'll grow right back, and you can usually get about three successions out mm-hmm. of them. So
you started out selling a little of those greens.
Right.
Two kinds at the Windsor Farmers Market in a little stall.
Yes.
I have to say, I think you started out in the most difficult farmers market in Sonoma County for a small producer.
I think it's true.
That was really challenging.
Yes. And
some of the characters, I want you to tell us more. Who was selling opium poppies? Are you going to give it up?
I think we'll just call him Grumpy Man. And I think if you go to the market, you will definitely be able to identify him by his VW bus.
Okay. And he's still there?
So,
we haven't been for a while. But,
yeah.
But we should also say that even though he's sort of labeled Grumpy Man, he's underneath, he's a really nice guy.
We actually love him.
Most grumpy farmers are sweethearts underneath.
Oh,
so you've just brought out, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to take a little musical break a little bit earlier than I planned on it, and we're going to find out what's causing the little disruption here in the studio. We'll be right back.
Oh, when you climb the high mountain, and the clouds don't let sun shine in.
Friendships never end. Time slowly
You're listening to Mouthful. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan, and we are talking with the author of The Wisdom of the Radish, Linda Hopkins, and her husband, Emmett Hopkins. Together, they farm Foggy River Farms. And I don't often tell people this, and there's no reason you should know if you've not been into the studio, but you shouldn't call the radio line when we're talking unless I specifically ask you to, because the phone rings here in the studio and there's no one to answer it. On those rare occasions when I do a call-in show, which is usually only once every couple of years if we have a big political issue on the ballot, then we have special people in a different room who answer the phone and we go through this whole complicated process to get the call on the air. So you can call when we take a musical break, but other than that, we can't answer. So there we go. Mystery solved. And that's why Joey was barking. Joey's here in the studio with me. He loves Studio A, and he protects it from all enemies, perceived or real. And, oh, I'm looking at little Charlotte. She's just so cute. So, Emmett, right when we were talking about the salad mix, you brought out two bags.
Yeah, I've got, we just happen to have some leftovers from the markets this weekend. You can guess why there might have been leftovers, because it was a downpour during the market, so we didn't get quite as many people as might have come out otherwise.
No, but this was at the Healdsburg market.
The Healdsburg, and we've started at the Santa Rosa market, so we've been going there just for 1 month now.
Oh.
So Linda's brother Craig and his girlfriend Emma are usually...
They go to the Santa Rosa?
There.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so. I did see you, not this week, but the week before.
Okay, yeah. So anyway, we've got some samples, and we're still growing the same two mixes, more or less, that we started with. So we've got our, just what we call our spring mix, which is a mix of seven or eight different lettuce varieties, red and green and flat and curled. And that's the one that takes about 3 weeks if it's going well. And then the second mix is what we call our zesty mix. We originally called it our brassica mix because it's all plants in the brassica family.
Mm-hmm.
Arugula, mustard greens, tatsoi, baby kale, and they're all small baby plants. But we didn't find that brassica mix caught on quite as much because not everyone knows what a brassica is.
A lot of people's eyes would glaze over.
Yeah, so we rebranded it, I guess you'd say, to our zesty mix, and people,
you know, and it's something, it'd be great to get that word into the commons more, because one of the best things you can eat, one of the best things for your health, as I'm sure you know, is brassicas.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very healthy foods, and we usually think most people think of them in their bigger, sturdier forms.
Right.
So to have brassica greens is really great.
Yeah, and so in the book there's a part where they're really full of holes, and you can, if you take a look, you'll see they still have some holes in them, which is sort of we're not certified organic, but we tell people that that's our organic certification.
The bugs
eat
them.
If they see a few holes in the leaves.
Absolutely. So yeah, that whole issue of certified organic is, that's a big challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's so expensive. There's so many things that you have to do. So I've been telling people through my comms and stuff, it's even the wrong question to ask a farmer these days. You need to know your farmer well enough to ask, how do you farm? Mm-hmm. What do you put?
Right.
You know,
right.
What sort of inputs?
Right, and we find that selling at the farmers markets, and then also our other main avenue for selling our produce is through our small CSA program, where people subscribe for a weekly subscription of vegetables from the farm. And we find that selling through those two avenues, we can do just fine without going through the certification process, because people do ask enough questions, and they are happy to. We have farm parties where people can come out and see everything.
Mm-hmm. And how many members do you have in your CSA?
We have about 50 this year.
Oh, 50. That's
so,
a pretty big CSA.
Yeah, we're trying to kind of get up to where we can self-sustain with the markets and the CSA, and really be able to earn a living on farming. And so we started with 20 members the first year, and then we just went to 30 last year and 50 this year. So we're not increasing super fast. We want to make sure we're doing a good job, but it's a lot of families. So,
And so back to the book. You lost a lot of seedlings too very early on.
Yes.
Do you describe what happened? I mean, what was it? Almost $200 worth of seed, and the seedlings just.
Yeah, it was one of those. It was, let's see, so 4 seasons ago, May was extremely hot, unlike this May. And we were just getting started, a really late start to the season, because we had just gotten back and just decided to do this farming thing. And we're sort of, you know, jumping all in and just trying to keep them watered at a time when it was extremely hot. We basically overwatered them, and that led to damping off, which is one of the saddest things you'll ever see in a plant. You have this little tiny baby plant, and then the stem is just pinched, basically shut. And then it can't get any water up from the roots.
And how does that happen? I've always wondered how that happens.
You know, they say it's often sort of linked to fungal growth. So okay. Sort of a fungus that kind of invades the root system, or it's kind of, yeah, one of those great mysteries of life. I imagine there's sort of a lot of different things that can okay. go wrong and lead to that.
Okay.
But... yeah, and it was also a real challenge because at that point we didn't actually have a set greenhouse. We just had a low hoop house that was about knee height, and mm-hmm. so that heats up really, really quickly. Yeah. And so trying to keep the temperature regulated in such a sort of small, you know, area of air, volume of air, yeah. is really challenging.
Yeah, so. That was a really tough year.
Yes.
The early heat waves I find much more challenging than the late rains.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you got chickens.
Yes, we did. And that was sort of the beginning of, I'd say, the livestock, I don't know, addiction or expedition. It's, you know, your choice of words.
Well, will you describe going to pick up the chickens? I know about this because I've talked to a number of people, but I think a lot of people don't realize. That was Charlotte, by the way. Don't realize... where you go to get your chickens.
It's a bizarre experience. You get a call at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and then you go to the post office, which is totally closed, but there's one person there who's sort of the night post office man, and he presents you with this cheaping cardboard box, and it has little air holes in it, and it's usually divided off into 4 sections, and sometimes 2 are just blank because they want to keep a bunch of you know, chicks together to stay warm. And you literally show up and get a box of birds from the closed post office at about 6 in the morning. So, and I usually order from a hatchery that's in California. It's just, I think it's based around Fresno.
Uh-huh.
And so the chickens are just, the little baby chicks are just in the mail overnight. So they don't have to spend too long, but they get there bright and early.
Yeah.
So.
And how do they get here? Are they driven? Are they flown?
You know, that's a really good question. I would imagine that they're driven, but I don't know for a fact. But I know that people also order them from the East Coast.
Those are flown.
And so those would have to be flown. Yeah.
There was a big problem. Oh, gosh, it could be as long ago as 10 years. I'm not sure. Where United Airlines cargo shipment or whatever, all of a sudden they said, we're not shipping poultry anymore.
Uh-oh.
And I knew some people who raised turkeys up here, and several people were suddenly like panicked. What are they going to do? And I think it was dissolved because we haven't seen these things to disappear.
Right.
But I know that was a real worry for a while.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. The post office for your chickens.
Yeah.
So those chickens didn't live a really long time.
No, sadly. It was one of those really steep learning curves that sometimes happens in farming. And we sort of fell in love with these little baby chicks over the course
impossible
of the first
not
month.
To.
Oh, yeah. We spent way too much time, you know, watching them. And it's so wonderful to see these little tiny creatures exhibit all of the behaviors of a fully grown chicken. You know, they're there dust bathing in their pine shavings, and they're scratching and they're pecking, and they have their little pecking order where, you know, some of them boss the other ones around, just like the large hens do. But when we went to put them out in the coop, the very second night that they were there, a fox dug under the coop and killed almost all of them.
Yeah, was it just the one that...
We had one that survived, and we named her Hope because she was sort of the last little thing in there, and sort of, you know, after the Emily Dickinson poem, Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul. That sort of flashed into my head, and so we named her that. And then we actually, a neighbor found another chicken the following day. She was running out wild, and, you know, so we got this call, you know, did you lose
a
small
chicken?
One of our chickens. So we actually had 2 survivors of the attack, but only one that we found sort of that morning.
Uh-huh.
And then the next one, she was around for about 24 hours. Luckiest chicken alive,
yeah,
I would
really?
Think.
No kidding.
Out in the big wild, so...
So is Hope still alive?
She is, in fact. Uh-huh. She's still on our farm, still laying eggs. And, she'll hopefully live a very long life and live and die on the farm.
And what breed is she?
She's an Americana, actually. She lays the beautiful blue-green eggs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what other breeds of chickens? I love chickens. I think everyone loves chickens right now.
Yes.
What other breeds do you have?
We have salmon favarels, which are a heritage French breed, and they have feathered feet and almost beards. Mm-hmm. Even the ladies do have a little bit of a beard, which is kind of fun. And then we also have blue, black, and splash Orpingtons, which are beautiful birds, sort of the steely gray color. And then the splash ones are white with flecks, and they're just huge, beautiful birds. Mm-hmm. And so we actually love them because the hens lay lots of eggs and they make great mothers. And then the roosters turn into wonderful meat birds. So they are very, so sort of the heritage birds, which were originally bred to be dual purpose, where you have the males for meat and the females for eggs.
So that makes sense.
Yes,
you know?
Makes a lot of sense because you don't need too many roosters. That's it's really a mistake to have too many roosters running around. They harass your hens all the time. Yeah. So.
Do you have any Cochins?
We do. We actually have Bantam Cochins.
Uh-huh. So, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, little guys.
Yeah, I had a Barred Cochin in a flock with seven others. There were two Barred Cochins, Eustacia and Ophelia.
I love the names.
But foxes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, foxes.
Have you heard about the sort of Cochin boom that happened where suddenly they were worth insane amounts of money back in the day?
No.
It was sort of like, I think there was a flower that this happened to as well.
It happened to the tulips.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was the same thing with Cochins, where suddenly everyone had to have the Cochin because they were this exotic breed with the beautiful feathered feet and they were so fluffy. And if you didn't have a Cochin, you know, you weren't really anybody.
Was that in the Victorian era?
I believe so. I believe it was in the Victorian
era. Interesting
time.
Because I know they've become sort of the bird du jour for city flocks on the East Coast. There was that article in the New Yorker either last year or the year before about raising chickens. And it was, you know, it was just after I'd gotten Ophelia. And I was like, oh, I had no idea that I picked the hip chick. I don't know if I like that or not. She was the one who jumped into my arms.
You were ahead of the curve, I mean.
Yes, I was. But she did. She jumped into my hands when I was looking at all these other little chicks.
Sometimes they choose you.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. So how many chickens do you have now?
It's always sort of
approximately
a fluctuating number, around 100 probably. Okay. Yeah.
And they get to run around during the day?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what we're hoping to do over the winter is build a mobile coop. Mm-hmm. But since we're on a very sloped space, it's kind of hard to figure out how to make a coop that will be able to travel, you know, over the hills. So right now we have different pastures and we open different pastures to them so that one pasture doesn't get overgrazed. So we're constantly in a state of regrowing the grass because in order to get the best eggs, you really need to have access to actual pasture. They need to be eating those weeds and weed seeds and bugs and grass. All those things, I think, make the yolks really wonderful.
Yeah.
And the chickens
and
happy.
Makes them happy.
Yes.
Yeah. So you sell your eggs. I know that you sell your eggs at the farmer's market. I took some pictures of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. We sell them at the Healdsburg market.
Yeah, Healdsburg market. And are you taking them down to the Santa Rosa market?
We aren't. We were told there may be a glut of eggs at the Santa Rosa market.
It's very interesting. This is the first year. Last year, eggs were a little bit more available, but still, most of the time you had to show up pretty early to get eggs at the market. And now farmers have eggs left over at the end of the day. Yeah. So, there's a lot of eggs at the Santa Rosa market.
Supply and demand in action, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think other farmers must have just seen eggs flying out of there. Because I'm a firm believer, once you've had a real egg, an egg from Happy Chickens, you can't go back.
Right.
They have no taste. Mm-hmm. And then you have to think about just the miserable lives those poor chickens live as well.
Yeah.
There's somebody else I wanted to ask you about in the book. I'm jumping back to the first chapter. We have Farmer Barbie.
Oh, yes.
And when you describe what she did or what she does, the best corn, she feeds, she provides her produce to a nearby prison. She's a practicing CPA with a master's degree in accounting.
Yes.
I have not encountered this person.
She is a phenomenal woman, and I really can't say enough good things about her. And it was just so funny because the first time we saw her, you know, she was this beautiful blonde lady at the farmer's market, and we're like, can she really be a farmer? You know, farmers don't look that good. You know, sort of usually you have the cracked hands and the, you know, didn't shower and that kind of a look. But she does it all herself, and she also is very busy during tax season, so... Yeah.
I just find that astonishing. And she's at the Windsor Market.
She is, yes. Uh-huh. And I believe she's still selling there. So,
yeah, I don't make it to the Windsor Market very often at all. I mean, it's, it coincides with the Sebastopol market, and that's my home market.
Right.
You know, I live just a mile from there, so it's really hard to tear me away from Sebastopol. Though I do have my spies who provide me with information at the for all the other markets that I may not get to. We're going to take one more musical break here, and we'll be right back with more talk on Muffle.
Look out, Mama, there's a white boat coming.
Well, the music tonight is the Beat Farmers and Country Dick Montana, leader of the Beat Farmers, the late Country Dick Montana, because they're a San Diego band, where Country Dick was from San Diego, and I think the band was founded there. And so in honor of Linda Hopkins' roots in San Diego, and mine as well. I didn't live there long, but I was sort of accidentally born there. So I do know San Diego pretty well. Let's taste some more. You brought some. I want you to tell us about what you're doing with your goat's milk.
Well, we love the goat's milk because we love making it into yogurt and fresh cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, fresh raw goat cheese isn't something that you can buy in any stores because legally in the United States, all raw cheeses have to be aged at least 60 days.
Yeah.
So this is something that you can't buy, but that we absolutely love to share with friends and family. And of course, eat lots of ourselves on our baby green
salads.
So you
make it, but you can't sell it.
Exactly. So, and we milk the goats. Well, I should say I milk the goats along with my brother twice a day, every day, about 12 hours apart. We milked them a little bit early this evening so that we could come here.
How many milkers do you have right now?
Right now we're milking 6 goats, but they're the Nigerians, so we're not getting the production that you would get with a standard size goat.
So these are the dwarf.
So, yes, exactly.
About how big is a full-grown one?
About the size of a Labrador Retriever. So anywhere from about 45 to 65 pounds, and most of mine, I'd say, are around 50 or a little bit under. So, and they can produce an amazing amount of milk for their size. Pound for pound, they actually produce more than the standard size. You sort of get more bang for your buck, I guess, in terms of the amount of feed that they require. But they produce less because, you know, a standard size goat could be 200 pounds. So about 4 times the size of a Nigerian.
And so, with that much milk, what do you do? Are you making all of it into cheese and
most
yogurt?
Of it. Yep.
Just for your family's use.
Yes, exactly. And then we also we have 2 livestock guard dogs that watch over our herd, and so in exchange for their labor, they get to enjoy raw goat's milk. It's sort of a mainstay of their diet.
Oh, nice. So. Very nice. Tell me about how, before we taste that cheese, it looks wonderful. Tell me about your yogurt and how you make your yogurt.
Yogurt is insanely easy. It's one of those things that everyone should be able to do at home.
I totally agree.
Wonderful. I mean, it's about 5 hours from sort of making it to putting it in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And what basically you just want to take existing yogurt. You take, what is it, a tablespoon,
couple
I think?
Tablespoons,
tablespoons per gallon of milk or per half gallon. I'm trying to remember. It's much better with remembering measurements than I am. And you heat it up to the specific temperature. Might want to look that one up online.
I know it's 180 degrees.
Yeah.
And then you cool it
down.
Yeah,
we heat it to 180, and then we cool it to
110.
In between about 108 and 112. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then let it sit at that temperature for five or six hours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, you're doing it from raw milk.
Yes,
we
but then
are,
we do heat it up to the 180.
Right. So what sort of are you getting thickness?
Yes.
You are.
Although we've actually had a little bit. Last year we had a really great thick culture going, and it was just almost like that Greek style yogurt, you know, really, really thick. And this year we haven't quite gotten that yet. And so, because we stopped the culture over the winter because we weren't milking the goats.
Sure.
So then you sort of have to start fresh. We're trying to sort of develop it again. We actually refroze some and we haven't defrosted that, but I'm wondering if maybe the frozen yogurt would still have the culture alive. I don't know.
Yeah. So, and I don't know either.
So it'll have to be an experiment.
I make a yogurt at home, not as often as I should. And I've never made it with goat's milk, but goat's milk yogurt is just fabulous.
Yeah. And I find that we use sort of the freshest milk, you know, so milk from that day or the previous night's milking, and you really don't get very much of the goaty flavor. It's just really rich and sweet.
Oh, yeah. Fresh goat milk is delicious.
Yeah. None it's not of that, what you think of when you think of goat milk.
Yeah. No, there's, you know, some people have bad memories,
yes.
But that's from a lot of it that I think came from canned goat milk. From canned milk, goat milk, and just from really aged.
Yes.
Where those goaty, earthy flavors.
Right. It takes mine about a week raw in the fridge to start tasting like goat milk. And then, so you sort of wonder, well, then when you buy goat milk in the store and it tastes like goat, then is it old milk? Or, you know, you sort of wonder what went wrong there because fresh goat milk is very sweet and clean tasting.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about your cheeses. It looks like you have 2 kinds here.
Yeah, we do. We have one that's an herbed chev and then one that's just plain. This one actually was just finished up today, the plain one. And then the other one was from a couple days ago, but still delicious and fresh. If you'd like to try some.
I would love to try some. And let's see, I've got to move the book here.
And we experiment with different things that we mix in. So sometimes we mix in like a, in this one it has Italian herbs mixed in, and then another one we'll mix in some Mexican spices, so it's a little bit spicy.
I'm going to try the plain one first. Lovely texture.
Oh, good.
Very fresh.
Good.
Really nice.
Thank
very,
you.
Very, very nice. It has that, I love the tang.
Yeah.
The acidity of goat cheese. Mm-hmm. And it's nice, and it's not, it's the right word, it's very clean on your palate. It doesn't coat your tongue. So, very good.
Thank
very
you.
Very good. It's a shame that it can't be sold.
Yeah. One of the secrets that we use is that we actually only use 2/5 of 1 drop of rennet. And how you get 2/5 of a drop of rennet, which is what everyone always asks when I say mm-hmm. that, is you actually measure out 5 tablespoons of water, and then you drop 1 drop of rennet in it, and then you scoop 2 tablespoons back out, so it's diluted. So it's a very minimal amount of rennet, which means that it's really creamy, and, you know, when you scoop it out into the molds, it's just sort of like a yogurty texture, and it just melts together. So if you use too much rennet, it tends to just be too hard.
You don't get that creamy, spreadable
texture.
So now I'm going to try the one with the Italian herbs, you said?
Mm-hmm.
From the garden?
Actually, this came from from the store, but we should get on our herb drying.
Very nice. Oregano.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Both really, really good cheeses. Now, when you have your farm parties, do people get to try them?
Absolutely. Yes. We have a wood-fired pizza oven down by the field.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll make a bunch of dough and then we'll fire it up, bring down the goat cheese, you know, bust out the fresh, you know, off the vine tomatoes and have a really fun pizza making party. Mm-hmm. So, actually we made our first sort of only our own cheese lasagna the other night. So we had goat milk ricotta, goat milk mozzarella, and then chèvre as well, which was really fun.
As you wrote the book, I mean, you're really, a lot of what you talk about in the book is you're clearly new at what you're doing and you're working through lots of resistances, you know, from, oh my God, you know, the seedlings all died, but just learning things. And it seems like you really had a problem with sheep for a while.
We did. Emmett, would you like to talk about the sheep?
Oh, the sheep. Well, I guess it really started, I mean, for our livestock, Linda, I guess I'd say Linda is the instigator on most of the livestock, starting with the chickens, and we kept sort of upgrading, and one of the upgrades was to the sheep. We have baby doll Southdown sheep, which we still have.
Uh-huh.
It's a very small flock. We just have half dozen.
Yeah, that's what they have out at Canvas Ranch.
Yep. Right, exactly. They're sort of like the body, almost the same size of a normal sheep, but just very short legs.
Mm-hmm.
And people like them.
They must have been bred with dachshunds.
Right. But people like them in Sonoma County because they can graze under the vineyards or in the orchards and not get high enough to eat anything they're not supposed to be eating. At any rate, we had a ram named Teddy. I guess that was our biggest problem with the sheep.
Yeah,
in the
Teddy
beginning.
Seemed to.
And Teddy.
Teddy the terror.
Lived up to the his name of being a ram, because he loved to ram people, and we were on a fairly steep slope on a hillside, and so if he was uphill from you and you turned your back and started walking down the hill back towards the gate, he would just kind of get up ahead of steam, and he knocked us both over several times.
Knocked the wind right out of us. We had some scars. There was some blood involved. You know, one time he pinned Emmett against the fence, and it was just—it was pretty awful. So
that he didn't give the sheep a great name.
No.
But we eventually ended up trading Teddy for a pair of alpacas.
Oh. You have alpacas.
So we have 2 alpacas now, and they don't do a whole lot. We were interested in them as sort of guardian animals for the sheep.
Yeah, I've heard that about them.
And ours, after we got them, we had lost a couple sheep to coyotes, so we're not sure how effective they are. They definitely protect their area. It's just the question of whether they bond to the flock well or not. And we don't think they bonded terrifically because they came in as adults, and our sheep were adults. So
yeah. Now, why do you have the sheep? What is their function on the farm?
Their main function, we have quite a bit of pasture land that's sort of too steep to be cultivated. And so the idea was to sort of bring the grasses down for fire abatement in the springtime. And then also they're actually a meat breed. But right now the cost of a live lamb is more than the cost of lamb meat because it's a heritage breed and everyone's really interested in starting up their own flock. So we haven't actually made them into lamb.
You sell breeding lambs.
Yeah. So they do earn their keep that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I remember right, they actually are not known for their pleasing personalities. And I wonder if there's an expectation because of their name.
Mm-hmm.
baby doll, they're going to be, you know, they're going to be little nuzzlers like Charlotte here.
Yeah, and they definitely look like teddy bears too. And so everyone, you know, sort of, oh, they look so cuddly. And I think that it really depends on how much you work with them. I've had people who really have, you know, trained them to become friendly. Mm-hmm. And I would be much more comfortable with a friendly weather than a friendly ram. You don't want a friendly ram because it ends up like Teddy, where, you know, he'll get a little bit overly aggressive. But I've definitely had people buy lambs and kind of work with them, feed them treats, and really they'll bond to people eventually. But it just takes some effort.
And we should say about Teddy, it wasn't that he was trying to hurt us or he was angry at us. He just wanted to play.
That's what he did.
And he came up and barreled into us. And then when we turned around and smacked him on the nose, he waggled his butt and said, oh, that was fun. Let's do it again.
And where's Teddy now?
He's on an alpaca farm in
Grass Valley.
Grass Valley.
Right. Okay,
right. Which
He's
is where
having a happy life.
What's the lifespan of these sheep?
It's about the same as goats, which is about the same as dogs. Okay. So it all depends on, there's, you know, obviously predation problems and things like that with chickens, where lifespans can be unexpectedly cut short. I would say, 7 to 12 to 15 years, depending on. I think I've heard of a 20-year-old sheep from someone, but that's quite an old grandma sheep.
I've known a few that had been around for a very, very, very long time. I know a number of people with sheep. There's some great stories. How is this season looking for you? You've got two of the things that you're selling. You've got these two salad mixes. What can people expect to start seeing in addition to the eggs when they come see you at the farmer's market?
Unfortunately, with all of this cold rain, it's a really slow season. It's been really hard on a lot of the farms in the area. Yeah. We're hoping that soon we'll have broccoli and cauliflower, but normally we would have had that already coming in by now. It's just taken a while because of the cold weather. Even the cold weather crops, they like the cold weather, but they don't grow as quickly as they would in warmer weather.
Right now we're bringing predominantly greens. We have chard and kale and baby bok choy, spinach, orak. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
It's sort of a
purple spinach, and the baby greens, head lettuces, and we're looking to start getting in more of our beets, root crops, and brassicas, like we were talking about earlier.
And then, are you going to do any of the typical summer crops, zucchini? And I was surprised. Zucchini has been at farmers markets now for about four or 5 weeks. I was really surprised that anyone had it, and some people are actually bringing in fairly substantial.
Right. Yeah, we do a lot of the summer crops, and we have great big zucchini plants right now, but haven't had any blossoms for the last weeks. One of the nice things and the challenges about doing a CSA is that it forces us to grow a wide
be
variety
really
because people don't want to be getting just greens every week for the whole year. So we do a nice spread of peppers and tomatoes and zucchini and winter squash in the fall, potatoes, onions.
Do you need any fruits, any melons or anything?
We do some melons.
We do
a couple of different heirloom, like an heirloom cantaloupe called Hale's Best, Rocky Ford, which is a very small green musk melon. And we grow crane melons, which of course are excellent. A couple different watermelons.
And, which ones?
We do one actually that we got from the Baker Creek Seed Company, which has all sorts of heirloom seeds. And they have one that Jer, who's the founder of the company, had written in the catalog that it was one of his favorite icebox size melons. Mm-hmm. And it comes from Thailand. It's called Thai Chat Chai.
And is it red or?
It's a small red, but it's really nice and crisp. And
I'll be interested in that when it comes out. And if you ever see seeds for sunshine, I'm trying to find somebody who will grow sunshine melons. There's a wonderful guy, Larry Fields, who is growing along the slopes, the eastern slopes of Sonoma Mountain. And he had eventually developed a serious raccoon problem. And then he also got a virus that only affected his watermelon plants. So he switched over to growing more musk melons. But I have never had better melons. He would call me and say, I'll be there. And I mean, I would go home every week with like six watermelons. But I haven't seen him for a while. But sunshine watermelon, it was a yellow watermelon.
Flesh,
it was so crisp. and it was just the most watermelon-flavored watermelon. It was delicious, absolutely delicious.
We'll have to look for it.
So tell me, when did the book came out? What, a couple months ago? What's the release date on the book?
I think it was March.
It was March. I was thinking it was April.
Yep.
And what's the word on it? How's it?
It's been actually really fun to hear back from people. We have lots of people coming up at the farmer's market and saying, oh, I just started the book, and so sorry to hear about your chickens. Or, you know, that's sort of the most common thing, I think, that people really resonate with. And, yeah, so it's been really wonderful to sort of feel, I don't know, as a writer, you work sort of by yourself, you know, as you know, in your little sort of writer cave, and then suddenly you put it out in the sunshine, and people actually start reading it, and it's wonderful to hear. It's scary, but it's also wonderful, because so far everyone's been really positive, and I think it also helps them feel like they have a little bit more of a connection to the farm, because we've had some of our farmers market customers and our CSA members as well read the book, and so they kind of feel like they have the inside scoop on how Foggy River Farm got started. So
sales are doing well in Sonoma County. What about elsewhere, nationwide? Is it getting some buzz?
Yeah, it's getting a little. We've actually had a little bit of buzz sort of on different farm blogs. So it's appeared on different farm and fooding, you know, foodie type blogs across the country, which has been fun. And actually, I got a request to go talk up at a bookstore up in Washington State. So I'll probably be headed there at some point this summer, which will be fun if I can peel myself away from the farm.
Yeah, that's one thing about farming. It's hard to get away.
Very difficult. Yeah, especially when not only do you have, you know, the vegetables, but the animals as well. Sure, the livestock definitely ties you down. So,
but it sounds like you have what, your brother, your sister,
some help, which is wonderful. And so he's, I'm the milkmaid and he's the milkman, and we trade off every other day, so our hands don't get too tired.
And you milk the goats by hand.
We do. We don't have a machine. You have to build up your muscles at the beginning of the season.
It's really using your muscles differently.
Totally. Yeah. And I've actually found that it has made sort of writing and typing in specific more difficult, because I build up these muscles and then my fingers aren't as flexible to hit the keys. Uh-huh. Yeah. So farming and writing are not necessarily always as compatible as one would like.
Are you working on something new, though?
I'd really love to follow up with a book on goat midwifery, because I really found it to be just so interesting being present as goats are giving birth, and I've learned a lot from the different goats.
I would read something like that in a heartbeat. Absolutely.
So we'll see.
Do you know Lori Chanel?
I don't know her personally. Of course, I know her cheese, which I devoured before I had goats of my own. So
you should. I mean, she started out up, you know, in Sebastopol because she loved goats. And, you know, I've never heard anyone talk more lovingly or more gently of goats than Lori. She's just got that connection to the animal.
Yeah.
It's really sweet.
It's really neat to see. And it's wonderful, too, because I think goats are an animal that can feel that connection back.
Mm-hmm.
They're not like dogs. They don't want to do what you want them to do, but you sort of develop a rapport with them. Mm-hmm. And they're always really grateful to have me there as sort of their midwife or doula, whatever you want to call it, as for their birth.
Interesting.
It's really neat. I actually had one goat, my herd queen, who bosses everybody else around. She's the matriarch. They have a matriarchal society just like the chickens do. And when she is close to going into labor, she will scream if I leave the barn.
Really?
So the first time she gave birth, I actually slept in the barn so that I would be by her side.
Really?
And she wouldn't be nervous.
So when she's getting ready, she just wants you nearby.
She wants me there.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
So. And then are their births easy?
Usually they are. Most of the time, nothing goes wrong, but you really want to be there for that few percent when something does go wrong.
Yeah.
And so actually this little Charlotte here, her mom had kind of a rough kidding about 9 days ago. So it was one of those dramatic, you know, I was supposed to be out at dinner, of course.
Of course.
You know, yeah, of course we have a reservation. And at that, you know, exact moment, I literally have, you know, my hand in a goat. And so it was very dramatic, but all's well that ends well. And she has three beautiful, happy kids now. So
she wasn't having triplets, was she?
There were quadruplets, but one was stillborn. There are still two other healthy babies back at home with mama.
So she had four. What is the typical number for a goat to have?
For Nigerians, the most common is twins, followed by triplets or singles. But they can have up to six at a time, which I wouldn't wish on any goat.
I don't know if I'd wish that on anyone. But I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they tend to have more multiples than the standard size goats. Uh-huh. For the standard size goats, I think that twins or singles are much more common.
Interesting. So we've just got, time flies. We've just got a couple minutes left. I'm sorry we were not able to answer the question about artichokes Rossini. I think we must have said something the listener who called about that misunderstood, because I don't remember us talking about Rossini for sure. Do you have any openings left in your CSA?
We have just a couple openings left. We're
so
almost full.
Do you want to give contact information?
Yeah, well, people can look us up at foggyriverfarm.org.
Foggyriverfarm, singular,
yes.
farm.org.
Yep.
And they can contact you that way for
exactly.
joining the CSA. And is it weekly?
It's a weekly pickup, Wednesday afternoons. Uh-huh. We do our pickups from 4 to 7 in the afternoon.
At the farm?
Most people come out to the farm, and we have a drop-off in Healdsburg as well.
And then what's the cost?
The cost is $22 a week.
Uh-huh. And figure family of three?
Yeah, either a vegetable-loving couple or a family of four with a couple kids.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And can we get Charlotte to say goodbye, do you think? Probably not.
Are you going
to
talk in the microphone?
Hey, Charlotte. Here we go. Charlotte's going to...
She's
no,
shy.
No, she saw the microphone and that was that. And I don't think Joey's going to talk.
There we go.
That is Charlotte. We have been talking with Emmett and Linda Hopkins. Linda is the author of The Wisdom of the Radish, published by Sasquatch Books. You can find it at your local bookstore. You can go to foggyriverfarm.org to find out about the CSA, or you can just show up at the Saturday Farmers Market in both Santa Rosa and in Healdsburg. Thank you so much for being my guest. I'm glad this finally worked out. I know we'd been trying for a while.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for having us, and thank you also for being such a wonderful farmers market shopper and supporter of the local farmers markets.
Thank you. I would be lost without. I would starve to death. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, here on KRCB.
To the Lord let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher said. To the Lord let praise be.
Mouthful is produced by Michelle Anna Jordan. It's engineered by Lawrence Alberti and Eric Black. For more information about Mouthful, email to catsmilk@sonic.net. That's catsmilk@sonic.net. You can also go to krcb.org and download podcasts of Mouthful, as well as from iTunes.
And the moral of this story, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough, even he'll get hungry too. And he'll sing,
to the Lord let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says. To the Lord let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says.
It's time for dinner, now let's go. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says.
To the Lord, let praise be.
Let it be.
It's time for dinner, now let's go.
We got some beans
and good cornbread.
Good cornbread.
Listen to what the preacher says.
Now let's go.